and was no longer there. Enoch stood in the oval room in the faint glow of the bulbs. There was the heavy smell of powder, and all about his feet, glinting in the light, lay the spent and shining cases that had been kicked out of the gun. He was back in the basement once again. The target shoot was over. Chapter 29. Enoch lowered the rifle and drew in a slow and careful breath. It always was like this, he thought, as if it were necessary for him to ease himself, by slow degrees, back to this world of his after the season of unreality. One knew that it would be illusion when he kicked on the switch that set into motion whatever was to happen, and one knew it had been illusion when it all had ended. But during the time that it was happening, it was not illusion. It was as real and substantial as if it all were true. They had asked him, he remembered, when the station had been built, if he had a hobby, if there was any sort of recreational facility they could build into the station for him, and he had said that he would like a rifle range, expecting no more than a shooting gallery with ducks moving on a chain or clay pipes rotating on a wheel. But that, of course, would have been too simple for the screwball architects who had designed and the slap-happy crew of workmen who had built the station. At first, they had not been certain what he meant by a rifle range, and he'd had to tell them what a rifle was and how it operated and for what it might be used. He had told them about hunting squirrels on sunny autumn mornings and shaking rabbits out of brush piles with the first coming of the snow, although one did not use a rifle but a shotgun on the rabbits, about hunting coons on an autumn night and waiting for the deer along the run that went down to the river. But he was dishonest, and he did not tell them about that other use to which he'd put a rifle during 4 long years. He'd told them, since they were easy folks to talk with, about his youthful dream of someday going on a hunt in Africa, although even as he told them he was well aware of how unattainable it was. But since that day he'd hunted, and been hunted by, beasts far stranger than anything that Africa could boast. From what these beasts might have been patterned, if indeed they came from anywhere other than the imagination of those aliens who had set up the tapes which produced the target scene, he had no idea. There had not, so far in the thousands of times that he had used the range, been a duplication either in the scene nor in the beasts which rampaged about the scene. Although, perhaps, he thought, there might be somewhere an end of them, and then the whole sequence might start over and run its course once more. But it would make little difference now, for if the tapes should start rerunning, there'd be but little chance of his recalling in any considerable detail those adventures he had lived so many years ago. He did not understand the techniques nor the principle which made possible this fantastic rifle range. Like many other things, he accepted it without the need of understanding. Although, someday, he thought, he might find the clue which in time would turn blind acceptance into understanding, not only of the range, but of many other things. He had often wondered what the aliens might think about his fascination with the rifle range, with that primal force that drove a man to kill, not for the joy of killing so much as to negate a danger, to meet force with a greater and more skillful force, cunning with more cunning. Had he wondered, given his alien friends concern in their assessment of the human character by his preoccupation with the rifle? For the understanding of an alien, how could one draw a line between the killing of other forms of life and the killing of one's own? Was there actually a differential that would stand up under logical examination between the sport of hunting and the sport of war? To an alien, perhaps, such a differentiation would be rather difficult, for in many cases the hunted animal would be more closely allied to the human hunter in its form and characteristics than would many of the aliens. Was war an instinctive thing, for which each ordinary man was as much responsible as the policy makers and the so-called statesmen? It seemed impossible, and yet, deep in every man was the combative instinct, the aggressive urge, the strange sense of competition, all of which spelled conflict of one kind or another if carried to conclusion. He put the rifle underneath his arm and walked over to the panel. Sticking from a slot in the bottom of it was a piece of tape. He pulled it out and puzzled out the symbols. They were not reassuring. He had not done so well. He had missed that first shot he had fired at the charging wolf thing with the old man's face, and back there somewhere, in that dimension of unreality, it and its companion were snarling over the tangled, torn mass of ribboned flesh and broken bone that had been Enoch Wallace. Chapter 30. He went back through the gallery, with its gifts stacked there as other gifts, in regular human establishments, might be stacked away in dry and dusty attics. The tape nagged at him. The little piece of tape which said that while he had made all his other shots, he had missed that first one back there on the hillock. It was not often that he missed, and his training had been for that very type of shooting, the you-never-know-what-will-happen-next, the totally unexpected, the kill-or-be-killed kind of shooting that thousands of expeditions into the target area had taught him. Perhaps, he consoled himself, he had not been as faithful in his practice lately as he should have been. Although there actually was no reason that he should be faithful, for the shooting was for recreation only, and his carrying of the rifle on his daily walks was from force of habit only, and for no other reason. He carried the rifle as another man might take along a cane or walking stick. At the time he had first done it, of course, it had been a different kind of rifle and a different day. It then was no unusual thing for a man to carry a gun while out on a walk. But today was different, and he wondered, with an inner grin, how much talk his carrying a gun might have furnished the people who had seen him with it. Near the end of the gallery, he saw the black bulk of a trunk projecting from beneath the lower shelf, too big to fit comfortably beneath it, jammed against the wall, but with a foot or two of it still projecting out beyond the shelf. He went on walking past it, then suddenly turned around. That trunk, he thought, that was the trunk which had belonged to the hazer who had died upstairs. It was his legacy from that being whose stolen body would be brought back to its grave this evening. He walked over to the shelving and leaned his rifle against the wall. Stooping, he pulled the trunk clear of its resting place. Once before, prior to carrying it down the stairs and storing it here beneath the shelves, he had gone through its contents. But at the time, he recalled, he'd not been too interested. Now, suddenly, he felt an absorbing interest in it. He lifted the lid carefully and tilted it back against the shelves. Crouching above the open trunk, and without touching anything to start with, he tried to catalog the upper layer of its contents. There was a shimmering cloak, neatly folded, perhaps some sort of ceremonial cloak, although he could not know. And atop the cloak lay a tiny bottle that was a blaze of reflected light, as if someone had taken a large-sized diamond and hollowed it out to make a bottle of it. Beside the cloak lay a nest of balls, deep violet and dull, with no shine at all, looking for all the world like a bunch of table tennis balls that someone had cemented together to make a globe. But that was not the way it was, Enoch remembered, for that other time he had been entranced by them and had picked them up, to find that they were not cemented, but could be freely moved about, although never outside the context of their shape. One ball could not be broken from the mass, no matter how hard one might try, but would move about, as if buoyed in a fluid, among all the other balls. One could move any or all of the balls, but the mass remained the same. A calculator of some sort, Enoch wondered, but that seemed only barely possible, for one ball was entirely like another. There was no way in which they could be identified, or, at least, no way to identify them by the human eye. Was it possible, he wondered, that identification might be possible to a hazer's eye? And if a calculator, what kind of a calculator? Mathematical, or ethical, or philosophical? Although that was slightly foolish, for who had ever heard of a calculator for ethics or philosophy? Or rather, what human had ever heard. More than likely it was not a calculator, but something else entirely. Perhaps a sort of game. A game of solitaire. Given time, a man might finally get it figured out. But there was no time, and no incentive at the moment, to spend upon one particular item any great amount of time when there were hundreds of other items equally fantastic and incomprehensible. For while one puzzled over a single item, The edges of his mind would always wonder if he might not be spending time on the most insignificant of the entire lot. He was a victim of museum fatigue, Enoch told himself, overwhelmed by the many pieces of the unknown scattered all about him. He reached out a hand, not for the globe of balls, but for the shining bottle that lay atop the cloak. As he picked it up and brought it closer, he saw that there was a line of writing engraved upon the glass, or diamond, of the bottle. Slowly he studied out the writing. There had been a time, long ago, when he had been able to read the Hazer language, if not fluently, at least well enough to get along. But he had not read it for some years now, and he had lost a good deal of it, and he stumbled haltingly from one symbol to another. Translated very freely, the inscription on the bottle read, "To be taken when the first symptoms occur." A bottle of medicine. To be taken when the first symptoms occur. The symptoms, perhaps, that had come so quickly and built up so rapidly that the owner of this bottle could make no move to reach it, and so had died, falling from the sofa. Almost reverently, he put the bottle back in its place atop the cloak, fitting it back into the faint impression it had made from lying there. So different from us in so many ways, thought Enoch, and then in other little ways so like us that it is frightening. For that bottle and the inscription on its face was an exact parallel of the prescription bottle that could be compounded by any corner drugstore. Beside the globe of balls was a box, and he reached out and lifted it. It was made of wood and had a rather simple clasp to hold it shut. He flipped back the lid, and inside he saw the metallic sheen of the material the Hazers used as paper. Carefully, he lifted out the first sheet and saw that it was not a sheet, but a long strip of the material folded in accordion fashion. Underneath it were more strips, apparently of the same material. There was writing on it, faint and faded, and Enoch held it close to read it. "To my blank, blank friend." Although it was not friend, blood brother, perhaps, or colleague, and the adjectives which preceded it were such as to escape his sense entirely. The writing was hard to read. It bore some resemblance to the formalized version of the language, but apparently bore the imprint of the writer's personality, expressed in curlicues and flourishes which obscured the form. Enoch worked his way slowly down the paper, missing much of what was there, but picking up the sense of much that had been written. The writer had been on a visit to some other planet, or possibly just some other place. The name of the place or planet was one that Enoch did not recognize. While he had been there, he had performed some sort of function, although exactly what it was not entirely clear, which had to do with his approaching death. Enoch, startled, went back over the phrase again. And while much of the rest of what was written was not clear, that part of it was. "My approaching death," he had written, and there was no room for mistranslation. All three of the words were clear. He urged that his good friend do likewise. He said that it was a comfort and made clear the road. There was no further explanation, no further reference. Just the calm declaration that he had done something which he felt must be arranged about his death. As if he knew death was near, and was not only unafraid, but almost unconcerned. The next passage, for there were no paragraphs, told about someone he had met, and how they'd talked about a certain matter which made no sense at all to Enoch, who found himself lost in a terminology he did not recognize. And then, "I am most concerned about the mediocrity, incompetence, inability, weakness, of the recent custodian of," and then that cryptic symbol which could be translated roughly as the talisman, for, a word which from the context seemed to mean a great length of time, "ever since the death of the last custodian, the talisman has been but poorly served. It has been, in all reality, another long time term, since a true, sensitive, has been found to carry out its purpose. Many have been tested, and none has qualified. And for the lack of such a one, the galaxy has lost its close identification with the ruling principle of life. We here at the temple, sanctuary, all are greatly concerned that without a proper linkage between the people and," several words that were not decipherable, the galaxy will go down in chaos, and another line that he could not puzzle out. The next sentence introduced a new subject, the plans that were going forward for some cultural festival, which concerned a concept that, to Enoch, was hazy at the best. Enoch slowly folded up the letter and put it back into the box. He felt a faint uneasiness in reading what he had, as if he'd pried into a friendship that he had no right to know. "We here at the temple," the letter had said. Perhaps the writer had been one of the Hazer mystics, writing to his old friend, the philosopher. And the other letters, quite possibly, were from that same mystic, letters that the dead old Hazer had valued so highly that he took them along with him when he went traveling. A slight breeze seemed to be blowing across Enoch's shoulders. Not actually a breeze, but a strange motion and a coldness to the air. He glanced back into the gallery, and there was nothing stirring, nothing to be seen. The wind had quit its blowing, if it had ever blown. Here one moment, gone the next. Like a passing ghost, thought Enoch. Did the Hazer have a ghost? The people back on Vega 21 had known the moment he had died, and all the circumstances of his death. They had known again about the body disappearing, and the letter had spoken calmly, much more calmly than would have been in the capacity of most humans, about the writer's near approach to death. Was it possible that the Hazers knew more of life and death than had ever been spelled out? Or had it been spelled out, put down in black and white, in some depository or depositories in the galaxy? Was the answer there? He wondered. Squatting there, he thought that perhaps it might be, that someone already knew what life was for and what its destiny. There was a comfort in the thought, a strange sort of personal comfort in being able to believe that some intelligence might have solved the riddle of that mysterious equation of the universe, and how, perhaps, that mysterious equation might tie in with the spiritual force that was idealistic brother to time and space, and all those other elemental factors that held the universe together. He tried to imagine what one might feel if he were in contact with the force, and could not. He wondered if even those who might have been in contact with it could find the words to tell. It might, he thought, be impossible. For how could one who had been in intimate contact all his life with space and time tell what either of these meant to him, or how they felt? Ulysses, he thought, had not told him all the truth about the talisman. He had told him that it had disappeared and that the galaxy was without it, but he had not told him that for many years its power and glory had been dimmed by the failure of its custodian to provide linkage between the people and the Force. And all that time the corrosion occasioned by that failure had eaten away at the bonds of the galactic co-fraternity. Whatever might be happening now had not happened in the last few years. It had been building up for a longer time than most aliens would admit. Although, come to think of it, most aliens probably did not know. Enoch closed the box lid and put it back into the trunk. Someday, he thought, when he was in the proper frame of mind, when the pressure of events made him less emotional, when he could dull the guilt of prying, he would achieve a scholarly and conscientious translation of those letters, for in them, he felt certain, he might find further understanding of that intriguing race. He might, he thought, then be better able to gauge their humanity. Not humanity in the common and accepted sense of being a member of the human race of Earth, but in the sense that certain rules of conduct must underlie all racial concepts, even as the thing called humanity, in its narrow sense, underlay the human concept. He reached up to close the lid of the trunk, and then he hesitated. "Someday," he had said. And there might not be a someday. It was a state of mind to be always thinking, "Someday." A state of mind made possible by the conditions inside this station. For here there were endless days to come. Forever and forever there were days to come. A man's concept of time was twisted out of shape and reason, and he could look ahead complacently down a long, almost never-ending avenue of time. But that might be all over now. Time might suddenly snap back into its rightful focus. Should he leave this station, the long procession of days to come would end. He pushed back the lid again until it rested against the shelves. Reaching in, He lifted out the box and set it on the floor beside him. He'd take it upstairs, he told himself, and put it with the other stuff that he must be prepared immediately to take along with him if he should leave the station. If? He asked himself. Was there a question any longer? Had he somehow made that hard decision? Had it crept upon him unaware, so that he now was committed to it? And if he had actually arrived at that decision, then he must, also, have arrived at the other one. If he left the station, then he could no longer be in a position to appear before Galactic Central to plead that Earth be cured of war. "You are the representative of the Earth," Ulysses had told him. "You are the only one who can represent the Earth." But could he, in reality, represent the Earth? Was he any longer a true representative of the human race? He was a 19th century man, and how could he, being that, represent the 20th? How much, he wondered, does the human character change with each generation? And not only was he of the 19th century, but he had, as well, lived for almost 100 years under a separate and a special circumstance. He knelt there, regarding himself with awe, and a little pity, too, wondering what he was, if he were even human, if, unknown to himself, he had absorbed so much of the mingled alien viewpoint to which he had been subjected that he had become some strange sort of hybrid, a queer kind of galactic half-breed. Slowly, he pulled the lid down and pushed it tight. Then he shoved the trunk back underneath the shelves. He tucked the box of letters underneath his arm and rose, picking up his rifle, and headed for the stairs. Chapter 31. He found some empty cartons stacked in the kitchen corner, boxes that Winslow had used to bring out from town the supplies that he had ordered, and began to pack. The journals, stacked neatly in order, filled one large box and part of another. He took a stack of old newspapers and carefully wrapped the 12 diamond bottles off the mantel, and packed them in another box, thickly padded, to guard against their breakage. Out of the cabinet, he got the Vegan music box and wrapped it as carefully. He pulled out of another cabinet the alien literature that he had, and piled it in the fourth box. He went through his desk, but there wasn't too much there, only odds and ends tucked here and there throughout the drawers. He found his chart and, crumpling it, threw it in the wastebasket that stood beside his desk. The already filled boxes he carried across the room and stacked beside the door for easy reaching. Lewis would have a truck, but once he let him know he needed it, it still might take a while for it to arrive. But if he had the important stuff all packed, he told himself, he could get it out himself and have it waiting for the truck. The important stuff, he thought. Who could judge importance? The journals and the alien literature, those first of all, of course. But the rest of it? Which of the rest of it? It was all important. Every item should be taken. And that might be possible. Given time and with no extra complications, it might be possible to haul it all away. All that was in this room and stored down in the basement. It all was his, and he had a right to it, for it had been given him. But that did not mean, he knew, that Galactic Central might not object most strenuously to his taking any of it. And if that should happen, it was vital that he should be able to get away with those most important items. Perhaps he should go down into the basement and lug up those tagged articles of which he knew the purpose. It probably would be better to take material about which something might be known than a lot of stuff about which there was nothing known. He stood undecided, looking all about the room. There were all the items on the coffee table, and those should be taken too, including the little flashing pyramid of globes that Lucy had set to working. He saw that the pet once again had crawled off the table and fallen on the floor. He stooped and picked it up and held it in his hands. It had grown an extra knob or two since the last time he had looked at it, and it was now a faint and delicate pink, whereas the last time he had noticed it had been a cobalt blue. He probably was wrong, he told himself, in calling it the pet. It might not be alive, but if it were, it was a sort of life he could not even guess at. It was not metallic, and it was not stone, but very close to both. A file made no impression on it, and he'd been tempted a time or two to whack it with a hammer to see what that might do, although he was willing to bet it would have no effect at all. It grew slowly, and it moved, but there was no way of knowing how it moved. But leave it, and come back, and it would have moved. A little, not too much. It knew that it was being watched, and it would not move while watched. It did not eat, so far as he could see, and it seemed to have no wastes. It changed colors, but entirely without season, and with no visible reason for the change. A being from somewhere in the direction of Sagittarius had given it to him just a year or two ago, and the creature, Enoch recalled, had been something for the books. He probably wasn't actually a walking plant, but that was what he'd looked like, a rather spindly plant that had been shorted on good water and cheated on good soil, but which had sprouted a crop of dime-store bangles that rang like 1,000 silver bells when he made any sort of motion. Enoch remembered that he had tried to ask the being what the gift might be, but the walking plant had simply clashed its bangles and filled the place with ringing sound and didn't try to answer. So he had put the gift on one end of the desk, and hours later, after the being was long gone, he found that it had moved to the other end of the desk. But it had seemed too crazy to think that a thing like that could move, so he finally convinced himself that he was mistaken as to where he'd put it. It was not until days later that he was able to convince himself it moved. He'd have to take it when he left, and Lucy's pyramid, and the cube that showed you pictures of other worlds when you looked inside of it, and a great deal of other stuff. He stood with the pet held in his hand, and now, for the first time, he wondered at why he might be packing. He was acting as if he'd decided he would leave the station, as if he'd chosen Earth as against the galaxy. But when and how, he wondered, had he decided it? Decision should be based on weighing and on measuring, and he had weighed and measured nothing. He had not posed the advantages and the disadvantages and tried to strike a balance. He had not thought it out. Somehow, somewhere, it had sneaked up on him, this decision which had seemed impossible, but now had been reached so easily. Was it, he wondered, that he had absorbed, unconsciously, such an odd mixture of alien thought and ethics that he had evolved, unknown to himself, a new way in which to think? Perhaps some subconscious way of thought that had lain inoperative until now, when it had been needed? There was a box or two out in the shed, and he'd go and get them and finish up the packing of what he'd pick out here. Then he'd go down into the basement and start lugging up the stuff that he had tagged. He glanced toward the window and realized, with some surprise, that he would have to hurry, for the sun was close to setting. It would be evening soon. He remembered that he'd forgotten lunch, but he had no time to eat. He could get something later. He turned to put the pet back on the table, and as he did, a faint sound caught his ear and froze him where he stood. It was the slight chuckle of a materializer operating, and he could not mistake it. He had heard the sound too often to be able to mistake it. And it must be, he knew, the official materializer, for no one could have traveled on the other without the sending of a message. Ulysses, he thought. Ulysses coming back again, or perhaps some other member of Galactic Central, for if Ulysses had been coming, he would have sent a message. He took a quick step forward so he could see the corner where the materializer stood, and a dark and slender figure was stepping out from the target circle. Ulysses! Enoch cried, but even as he spoke, he realized it was not Ulysses. For an instant, he had the impression of a top hat, of white tie and tails, of a jauntiness, and then he saw that the creature was a rat that walked erect, with sleek, dark fur covering its body and a sharp, axe-like rodent face. For an instant, as it turned its head toward him, he caught the red glitter of its eyes. Then it turned back toward the corner, and he saw that its hand was lifted and was pulling out a harnessed holster hung about its middle, something that glinted with a metallic shimmer even in the shadow. There was something very wrong about it. The creature should have greeted him. It should have said hello and come out to meet him. But instead, it had thrown him that one red-eyed glance and then turned back to the corner. The metallic object came out of the holster, and it could only be a gun, or at least some sort of weapon that one might think of as a gun. And was this the way, thought Enoch, that they would close the station? One quick shot, without a word, and the station keeper dead upon the floor? With someone other than Ulysses, because Ulysses could not be trusted to kill a longtime friend. The rifle was lying across the desktop, and there wasn't any time. But the rat-like creature was not turning toward the room. It still was facing toward the corner, and its hand was coming up, with the weapon glinting in it. An alarm twanged within Enoch's brain, and he swung his arm and yelled, hurling the pet toward the creature in the corner. The yell jerked out of him involuntarily from the bottom of his lungs. For the creature, he realized, had not been intent on the killing of the keeper, but the disruption of the station. The only thing there was to aim at in the corner was the control complex, the nerve center of the station's operation, and if that should be knocked out, the station would be dead. To set it in operation once again, it would be necessary to send a crew of technicians out in a spaceship from the nearest station, a trip that would require many years to make. At Enoch's yell, the creature jerked around, dropping toward a crouch, and the flying pet, tumbling end for end, caught it in the belly and drove it back against the wall. Enoch charged, arms outspread to grapple with the creature. The gun flew from the creature's hand and pinwheeled across the floor. Then Enoch was upon the alien, and even as he closed with it, his nostrils were assailed by its body stench, a sickening wave of nastiness. He wrapped his arms about it and heaved, and it was not as heavy as he thought it might be. His powerful wrench jerked it from the corner and swung it around and sent it skidding out across the floor. It crashed against a chair and came to a stop, and then, like a steel coil, it rose off the floor and pounced for the gun. Enoch took two great strides and had it by the neck, lifting it and shaking it so savagely that the recovered gun flew from its hand again, and the bag it carried on a thong across its shoulder pounded like a vibrating trip hammer against its hairy ribs. The stench was thick, so thick that one could almost see it, and Enoch gagged on it as he shook the creature, and suddenly it was worse, much worse, like a fire raging in one's throat and a hammer in one's head. It was like a physical blow that hit one in the belly and shoved against the chest. Enoch let go his hold upon the creature and staggered back, doubled up and retching. He lifted his hands to his face and tried to push the stench away, to clear his nostrils and his mouth, to rub it from his eyes. Through a haze, he saw the creature rise and, snatching up the gun, rush toward the door. He did not hear the phrase that the creature spoke, but the door came open, and the creature spurted forward and was gone. And the door slammed shut again. Chapter 32. Enoch wobbled across the room to the desk and caught at it for support. The stench was diminishing, and his head was clearing, and he scarcely could believe that it all had happened. For it was incredible that a thing like this should happen. The creature had traveled on the official materializer, and no one but a member of Galactic Central could travel by that route. And no member of Galactic Central, he was convinced, would have acted as the rat-like creature had. Likewise, the creature had known the phrase that would operate the door. No one but himself and Galactic Central would have known that phrase. He reached out and picked up his rifle and hefted it in his fist. It was all right, he thought. There was nothing harmed, except that there was an alien loose upon the Earth, and that was something that could not be allowed. The Earth was barred to aliens, as a planet which had not been recognized by the Galactic Co-Fraternity. It was off-limit territory. He stood with the rifle in his hand and knew what he must do. He must get that alien back. He must get it off the Earth. He spoke the phrase aloud and strode toward the door and out and around the corner of the house. The alien was running across the field and had almost reached the line of woods. Enoch ran desperately, but before he was halfway down the field, the rat-like quarry had plunged into the woods and disappeared. The woods was beginning to darken. The slanting rays of light from the setting sun still lighted the upper canopy of the foliage, but on the forest floor, the shadows had begun to gather. As he ran into the fringe of the woods, Enoch caught a glimpse of the creature angling down a small ravine and plunging up the other slope, racing through a heavy cover of ferns that reached almost to its middle. If it kept on in that direction, Enoch told himself, it might work out all right. for the slope beyond the ravine ended in a clump of rocks that lay above an outthrust point that ended in a cliff, with each side curving in, so that the point and its mass of boulders lay isolated, a place hung out in space. It might be a little rough to dig the alien from the rocks if it took refuge there, but at least it would be trapped and could not get away. Although, Enoch reminded himself, he could waste no time, for the sun was setting and it would soon be dark. Enoch angled slightly westward to go around the head of the small ravine, keeping an eye on the fleeing alien. The creature kept on up the slope, and Enoch, observing this, put on an extra burst of speed. For now he had the alien trapped. In its fleeing, it had gone past the point of no return. It could no longer turn around and retreat back from the point. Soon it would reach the cliff edge, and then there'd be nothing it could do but hole up in the patch of boulders. Running hard, Enoch crossed the area covered by the ferns and came out on the sharper slope some 100 yards or so below the boulder clump. Here, the cover was not so dense. There was a scant covering of spotty underbrush and a scattering of trees. The soft loam of the forest floor gave way to a footing of shattered rock, which through the years had been chipped off the boulders by the winter's frost, rolling down the slope. They lay there now, covered with thick moss, a treacherous place to walk. As he ran, Enoch swept the boulders with a glance, but there was no sign of the alien. Then, out of the corner of his vision, he saw the motion, and threw himself forward to the ground behind a patch of hazel brush. And through the network of the bushes he saw the alien outlined against the sky, its head pivoting back and forth to sweep the slope below, the weapon half lifted and set for instant use. Enoch lay frozen, with his outstretched hand gripping the rifle. There was a slash of pain across one set of knuckles, and he knew that he had skinned them on the rock as he had dived for cover. The alien dropped from sight behind the boulders, and Enoch slowly pulled the rifle back to where he would be able to handle it should a shot present itself. Although, he wondered, would he dare to fire? Would he dare to kill an alien? The alien could have killed him back there at the station when he had been knocked silly by the dreadful stench, but it had not killed him. It had fled instead. Was it, he wondered, that the creature had been so badly frightened that all it could think of had been to get away? Or had it, perhaps, been as reluctant to kill a station keeper as he himself was to kill an alien? He searched the rocks above him, and there was no motion and not a thing to see. He must move up that slope, and quickly, he told himself, for time would work against him and to the advantage of the alien. Darkness could not be more than 30 minutes off, and before dark had fallen, this issue must be settled. If the alien got away, there'd be little chance to find it. And why, asked a second self, standing to one side, should you worry about alien complications? For are you yourself not prepared to inform the Earth that there are alien peoples in the galaxy, and to hand to Earth, unauthorized, as much of that alien lore and learning as may be within your power? Why should you have stopped this alien from the wrecking of the station, ensuring its isolation for many years? For if that had been done, then you'd have been free to do as you might wish with all that is within the station. It would have worked to your advantage to have allowed events to run their course. But I couldn't, Enoch cried inside himself. Don't you see I couldn't? Don't you understand? A rustle in the bushes to his left brought him around with the rifle up and ready. And there was Lucy Fisher, not more than 20 feet away. Get out of here, he shouted, forgetting that she could not hear him. But she did not seem to notice. She motioned to the left and made a sweeping motion with her hand and pointed toward the boulders. Go away, he said underneath his breath. Go away from here. Then made rejection motions to indicate that she should go back, that this was no place for her. She shook her head and sprang away in a running crouch, moving further to the left and up the slope. Enoch scrambled to his feet, lunging after her, and as he did, the air behind him made a frying sound, and there was the sharp bite of ozone in the air. He hit the ground instinctively, and farther down the slope he saw a square yard of ground that boiled and steamed, with the ground cover swept away by a fierce heat, and the very soil and rock turned into a simmering pudding. A laser, Enoch thought. The alien's weapon was a laser, packing a terrific punch in a narrow beam of light. He gathered himself together and made a short rush up the hillside, throwing himself prone behind a twisted birch clump. The air made the frying sound again, and there was an instant blast of heat and the ozone once again. Over on the reverse slope, a patch of ground was steaming. Ash floated down and settled on Enoch's arms. He flashed a quick glance upward and saw that the top half of the birch clump was gone, sheared off by the laser and reduced to ash. Tiny coils of smoke rose lazily from the severed stumps. No matter what it may have done, or failed to do, back there at the station, the alien now meant business. It knew that it was cornered, and it was playing vicious. Enoch huddled against the ground and worried about Lucy. He hoped that she was safe. The little fool should have stayed out of it. This was no place for her. She shouldn't even have been out in the woods at this time of day. She'd have old Hank out looking for her again, thinking she was kidnapped. He wondered what the hell had gotten into her. The dusk was deepening. Only the far peak of the treetops caught the last rays of the sun. A coolness came stealing up the ravine from the valley far below, and there was a damp, lush smell that came out of the ground. From some hidden hollow, a whippoorwill called out mournfully. Enoch darted out from behind the birch clump and rushed up the slope. He reached the fallen log he'd picked as a barricade and threw himself behind it. There was no sign of the alien, and there was not another shot from the laser gun. Enoch studied the ground ahead. Two more rushes, one to that small pile of rock, and the next to the edge of the boulder area itself, and he'd be on top of the hiding alien. And once he got there, he wondered, what was he to do? Go in and rout the alien out, of course. There was no plan that could be made, no tactics that could be laid out in advance. Once he got to the edge of the boulders, he must play it all by ear, taking advantage of any break that might present itself. He was at a disadvantage in that he must not kill the alien, but must capture it instead and drag it back, kicking.